Chapter 12. Mine was a pleasant room, small, but still large enough for my requirements. I was gratified indeed to notice that I had two low tables, and one of those low tables had quite a number of magazines and papers on it. On the other table, there were some very nice things laid out for me, those sweet things of which I so heartily approved. As I entered, a monk attendant smiled at me and said, "The gods of fortune have certainly smiled upon you, Lobsang. You are right next door to the High Lama, Mingyar Dondup." I knew that. He was telling me things I already knew. But then he said, "Here is a communicating door. You must remember never to enter that door without permission from your guide, because he may be in deep meditation. Now you cannot see your guide for a little time, so I suggest you get down to that food." With that he turned away and left my room. My room, it sounded good. It was a wonderful thing to have a room of my own after having had to sleep very publicly with a lot of other boys. I walked across to the table, bent down and carefully examined all the good things displayed there. After a frenzy of uncertainty, I decided which I would have, a sort of a pink thing with a white dusting on top. I picked it up with my right hand, and then for good measure I picked up another with my left hand. Then I went to the window to see just where I was in the building. I rested my arms in the stone of the recessed window frame and poked my head outside, muttering a very unfortunate word as I dropped one of my Indian cakes in the process. Hastily, I gobbled up the other, lest it, too, should share that fate. Then I returned to my scrutiny of the landscape. Here, I was at the extreme southeastern part of the building. I had the last room, right on the corner of the annex. I could see the Jewel Park, the Norbu Linga. At present, there were a number of lamas poking about. They seemed to be having a debate, making quite a number of gestures. For a few idle moments, I watched them. They were quite amusing. One was posturing on the ground, and the other was declaiming to him. Then they changed places. Oh, yes, I knew what they were doing. They were rehearsing for the public debates, because the Dalai Lama himself was going to take part in a public lamastic debate. Satisfied that I had not missed anything that I should know about, I turned to other things. A few pilgrims were pottering along on the Lingor Road, pottering about as if they expected to find gold beneath every bush or beneath every stone. They were a motley collection. Some of them were orthodox pilgrims, really sincere. Others, as I could tell without much trouble, were spies, Russian spies, who were spying upon the Chinese and us, and Chinese spies who were spying on the Russians and on us. I thought that as long as they spied upon each other, they might leave us alone. Right below my window was a swamp with a little river running through it and emptying into the Happy River. There was a bridge over the river which carried the Lingor Road. I watched in some amusement because there was a small group of towns boys there. Blackheads, as we called them, because they hadn't shaven heads as we monks had. They were fooling about on this bridge, throwing little bits of wood over on one side and dashing across to the other side to see them reappear. One boy overbalanced with suitable assist from one of his companions, and over he went, head first, into the water. However, it was not very serious. He managed to drag himself ashore, covered in a particularly gluey mud, which already I, to my cost, had encountered in that river. Then all the boys rushed down the bank and helped him get clean, because they knew what mother and father would say to each of them if they all went back into Lhasa City and left the boy in such a horrid state. More to the east, the boatman was still plying his trade, ferrying across the river, making a great production of it in the hope of being able to drag a little more money out of his passengers. This was a thing that really interested me, because at that time I had never been on the water in a boat, and at that time it was really the height of my ambition. A little farther along the ferry road was another small park, the Kashya Linga, along the road which led to the Chinese mission. I could actually see the Chinese mission walls from my room, and I could look down on the garden, even though it was well shielded by trees. We boys always thought that horrible atrocities were taking place in the Chinese mission, and who knows, it may be that we were correct. More to the east was the Kati Linga, a very pleasant but somewhat damp park located in swampy ground. Farther away was the Turquoise Bridge, which I could see, and the sight of which delighted me. I thoroughly enjoyed seeing people enter the covered enclosure, later to emerge at the other end. Beyond the Turquoise Bridge, I could see the city of Lhasa, the council hall, and, of course, the golden roofs of the Jokang, the Cathedral of Lhasa, which was perhaps the oldest building in our country. Far beyond were the mountain ranges and the dotted hermitages and the great heaps of different lamasaries. Yes, I was well satisfied with my room, and then it occurred to me that I could not see the Potala. Simultaneously, the thought occurred to me that high officials of the Potala could not see me either. So, if I drop pebbles or lumps of sampa onto unsuspecting pilgrims, no one would see me, and the pilgrims would put it down to birds. In Tibet, we did not have beds. We slept on the floor. Most times, we did not have cushions or anything else on the floor. We just wrapped ourselves in blankets and lay down, perhaps using our robes as a pillow. But it was not time to retire. Instead, I sat with the window at my back so that the light streamed in over my shoulders, and I picked up a magazine. The title meant nothing to me, because it might have been English, French, or German. I couldn't read any of them. But as I turned to this particular magazine, it appeared to be an Indian one, because they had a sort of map on the cover, and I could recognize some of the names, some of the shapes of the words. I turned over the pages. The words meant nothing to me, and I devoted myself exclusively to the pictures. As I sat there, feeling content, feeling that my lot had changed for the better, I was quite happy to just look at pictures while my thoughts wandered far afield. Idly, I turned the pages, and then I stopped and I laughed and laughed and laughed to myself. Here in the two center pages were a collection of men, standing on their heads, tying themselves into knots and all sorts of things of that nature. Now I knew what I was seeing. Some of the yoga exercises, which were then very much the cult in India, I laughed hard and loud at some of the expressions, then stopped suddenly as I looked up and saw my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, smiling at me through the open communicating door. Before I could scramble to my feet, he waved me down, saying, "No, we want no formality here, Lobsang. Formality is suitable for formal occasions, but this room is your home, just as my room," he mentioned through the open doorway, "is my home. But what was making you laugh so much?" I suppressed my rising mirth and pointed to the yoga pictures. My guide came into the room and sat on the floor with me. "You should not laugh at other people's beliefs, you know, Lobsang, because you wouldn't like other people to laugh at your beliefs. These are practicing yoga. I do not do yoga, nor do any of the high lamas do it. Only those who have no ability to do metaphysical things do yoga." "Master," I said in some excitement, "will you tell me something about yoga? How people do it? What is it? I'm very puzzled about the whole thing." My guide looked at his fingers for a moment and then answered me, saying, "Well, yes, you have to learn about these things. Let us talk about them now. I will tell you something about yoga." I sat and listened while my guide talked. He had been everywhere, and seen everything, and done everything, and I wanted nothing so much as to model myself upon him. I listened with more care than a small boy would normally give as he talked to me. "I am not interested in yoga," he said, "because yoga is merely a means of disciplining the body. If a person already has discipline of the body, then yoga becomes merely a waste of time. In this, our country, no one except the very lower classes ever practices yoga. The Indians have made very much of a cult of yoga, and I regret that exceedingly, because it is leading one away from the real truths. It is conceded that before one can do various metaphysical practices, one must have control of the body, must be able to control one's breathing, one's emotions, one's muscles, but I am opposed to yoga because it is merely trying, by brute force, to do that which should be achieved by spiritual means." While he was talking, I was looking at the pictures, and it did seem remarkable that people should try to tie themselves up in knots and thinking it was being spiritual. But my guide continued, "Many of the lower types of Indians can do a form of trick by indulging in yoga. They are able to do hypnotism and various other tricks, which they have made themselves believe is a truly spiritual thing. Instead, it is a trick and nothing more. I have never heard of anyone going to the heavenly fields on the basis of being able to tie his body up in knots," he said with a laugh. "Why do people do such remarkable things?" I asked. "There are certain things, certain physical manifestations, which can be achieved by yoga, and there is no doubt that if one practices yoga, it can perhaps develop a few muscles, but that does not help in developing spirituality. Many of the Indians put on exhibitions, and such men are called fakirs. They travel from village to village and town to town, putting on yoga exhibitions, perhaps tying oneself up in knots, as you call it, or keeping one's arm above one's head for a long time, or doing other remarkable things. They put on a holy pose as if they're doing the most wonderful thing of all, and because they are a noisy minority who bask in publicity, people have reached the conclusion that yoga is an easy way to reach the great truths. This is completely wrong. Yoga merely assists one to develop or control or discipline the body, and it does not help one achieve spirituality. He laughed and said, "You would hardly believe this, but when I was a very young man, I tried yoga myself, and I found that I was spending so much time trying to do a few childish exercises that I had not sufficient time left to devote to spiritual progress. So, on the advice of a wise old man, I gave up yoga and got down to serious business." He looked at me and then stretched his arm in the direction of Lhasa. He swung it round to include the direction of the Patala, saying, "In all our country, you will not find the higher types of Lama doing yoga. They get down to the real thing, and you will always find that the yogas make a lot of public commotion, saying how wonderful they are, how important they are, and how they have the keys to salvation and spirituality. Yet the true adept of metaphysics does not talk about what he really can do. Unfortunately, in yoga, it is a noisy minority which tries to sway public opinion. My advice to you, Lobsang, is this. Never, never bother with yoga, for it is quite useless to you. You were born with certain powers, clairvoyance, telepathy, and whatnot, but you have absolutely no need, whatever, to dabble with yoga. It could even be harmful." While he had been talking, I had been turning the pages quite without thinking, and as I looked down I peered, because I saw what seemed to be a Western man wearing a contorted expression as he was trying to do an exercise. I pointed it out to my guide, who looked at it and said, "Yes, this is a victim of yoga. A Western man who tried an exercise and dislocated a bone in the process. It's a very, very unwise thing for Westerners to try yoga because their muscles and bones are not supple enough. One should only do yoga if one really wants to, if one is trained from a very early age. For middle-aged people to do it, well, it's foolish and definitely harmful. It is ridiculous, though, to say that the practice of yoga causes illness. It does not. All it does is to bring into use a few muscles, and at a time a person may get a dislocation or a strained muscle, but that is the person's own fault. They should not meddle with such things." He laughed as he folded the paper and said, "The only yogi I have met have been real cranks. They have thought they were the cleverest people ever. They thought that they knew everything, and they thought that the practice of yoga was the salvation of the world. Instead, It's just an exercise, such as when you boys climb a tree or on stilts, and when you run so that a kite may be lofted into the air. Yoga, just a physical exercise, nothing more, nothing spiritual. Possibly it can help one by improving one's physical condition, so that then one is able to forget about yoga and get on with things that matter, the things of the spirit. After all, in a few years, everyone leaves the body. It does not matter then if the body is full of hard muscle and strong bone. The only thing that matters then is the state of the spirit. He returned to the subject, saying, "Oh, and I should warn you of this. Many practitioners of yoga forget theirs is just a physical training cult. Instead, they have taken some of our occult healing practices and said that these healing practices are an adjunct of yoga. Such is completely false. Any of the healing arts can be done by a person entirely ignorant of yoga, and often done far better. So," he pointed at me sternly, "don't you ever fall victim to yoga publicity. It can actually lead you away from the path." He turned and walked into his room. Then he turned back to me, saying, "Oh, I have some charts here, which I want you to fix on your wall. You'd better come and get them." Then he came over to me and lifted me up so that I should not have to struggle getting up by myself. I walked behind him into his room, and there on the table were three rolled papers. He held one up, saying, "This is a very old Chinese picture, which many hundreds of years ago was made in veneered wood. It is at present in the city of Peking. But in this representation, I want you to study carefully how the organs of the body are imitated by monks doing various tasks." He stopped and pointed to one particular thing. "Here," he said, "monks are busy mixing food and fluid. That is the stomach. The monks are preparing all this food to pass through various pipes before it reaches other monks. If you study this, you will get a very good idea of the basic workings of the human body." He rolled up the scroll again, carefully tied it with little tapes which were already affixed to it, and then he took another and held it up for me to see. "Here," he continued, "is a representation of the spine with various chakras. You will see from this how the very different centers of power are located between the base of the spine and the top of the head. This chart must be right in front of you so that you see it last thing at night and first thing in the morning." Carefully he rolled up the scroll and tied that, and then he went on to the next one, the third. He untied the fastening and held the chart at arm's length. "Here is a representation of the nervous system, showing you things which you will have to study, such as the cervical ganglion, the vagus nerve, the cardiac plexus, solar plexus, and pelvic plexus. All these things you have to know because they are quite essential to you as a medical lama in training." I looked at the things, feeling more and more despondent, because it seemed to me that I should never master all these things. All the bits and squiggles of the human body, all the wriggly bits that were nerves and the great blobs that were chakras. But I thought, I've got plenty of time. Let me just go at my own speed, and if I cannot learn as much as I think I should, well, one cannot do more than one's best. Now, I suggest you go and get some air. Just put these in your room, and then whatever you do for the rest of the day is your own affair, unless you get up to some mischief, he said with a smile. I bowed respectfully to him and picked up the three scrolls. Then I returned to my own room, shutting the communicating door between us. For a time I stood in the center of the room wondering how I should fix these wretched things, and then I observed that there were already suitable projections in the wall. Carefully, I took a table and placed it beneath one of the projections. Climbing the table, which gave me another foot or 18 inches of height, I managed at last to get the cord of the first chart over the projection. Carefully, I retreated to the far side of the room and looked approvingly at my handiwork. No, it was not straight. I eyed the thing critically and hurried forward to make sure that everything was as correct as it should be. Satisfied that one was hanging true and level, I went to work on the next. At last I was satisfied, and I dusted my hands together with an air of complacency. Smiling with self-satisfaction, I walked out of my room, wondering which way to go. But as I went out, passing my guide's door, I saw the serving monk at the end of the corridor. He greeted me in friendly fashion and said, "That's the quickest way out. It's a private door for lamas, but I've been told that you are permitted to use it." He motioned to it, and I thanked him and soon slipped out into the fresh air. I stood outside in the open. The end of the mountain path lay just beneath my feet. Over to the right, a crowd of monks were busy working. It looked to me as if they were leaning up the road, but I did not hang about. I did not want to be sent on any tasks. Instead, I moved directly forward and sat on a boulder for a time while I looked out over the city, not so far away, near enough for me to distinguish in the clear air of Tibet the dress of the traders, the monks, and the lamas who were going about their business. Soon, I moved a few yards down and sat on another rock beside which there was a pleasant small bush. My attention now wandered to the swamp below me. The swamp, where the grass was lush and green, and where I could distinguish bubbles as fish lurked in the deeper pools. As I sat, there was a sudden rushing behind me, and a hoarse, throaty voice said, "Prrr, prrr." With that, there was a hearty boink in the small of my back, as a solid, furry head greeted me. I reached round and stroked the old cat, and he licked me with a tongue which was as rough as the gravel on the ground. Then he rushed round to the front, jumped on my lap, jumped off, and made off through some bushes, stopping just in sight, wheeling round to face me. He looked the very picture of inquiry as he sat there, tail straight up, ears straight up, facing towards me with his blue eyes glinting. I made no move, so he rushed up the hill, again towards me, saying, "Prrr, prrr." As I still made no move, he reached out with one of his paws and hooked his claws in the bottom of my robe and gently tugged. "Oh, cat, whatever is the matter with you?" I asked in exasperation. Slowly I scrambled to my feet and looked about to see what the cat was agitating about. There was nothing to be seen, but the cat was rushing towards a bush in the distance, and then rushing back to me and clawing at my robe, so I faced down the mountainside and began a slow, cautious descent, the cat fairly dancing with excitement, whirling round, springing in the air, and charging at me. I clung to the bushes as I made my slow way, and I reached the point where the cat had turned to face me, but there was nothing to be seen. "Cat, you are an idiot," I said with irritation. "You've dragged me down here just to play." "Prrr, prrr," said the cat, clawing at my robe again and weaving between my legs, poking beneath my robe and nibbling at my bare toes showing through my sandals. With a sigh of resignation, I progressed a bit farther, pushed my way through a bush, and clung on grimly because here was a ledge, and had I not been clinging on so grimly, I could have fallen over the edge. I turned to say some very unkind things to Friend Cat, who was now in a frenzy of excitement. Darting around me, he sprang over the edge. My heart nearly stopped with shock, for the old cat was a very good friend of mine, and I thought he had committed suicide. Very cautiously, I sank to my knees, and clinging hold of the bushes, peered over the edge. About 12 feet below me, I saw the body of an aged monk. My horrified eyes saw that his head was blood-stained, and that his robe had also blood on it. His right leg, I perceived, was bent at an unnatural angle. My heart was palpitating with fright, excitement, effort. I looked about me and I found that just off to the left there was a small declivity down which I could descend, finding myself then at the head of the old monk. Gingerly, nearly ready to jump out of my skin with fright, I touched him. He was alive. As I touched him, his eyes flickered feebly and he groaned. I saw that he had fallen over and struck his head on a rock. The cat was now sitting, watching me carefully. Gently, I stroked the old monk's head, stroking beneath the ears, down the neck, towards the heart. After some time, his eyes opened, and he looked vacantly about him. Slowly, his eyes came into focus, focusing on me. "It's all right," I said soothingly. "I will go up and get help for you. I shall not be very long." The poor old man tried to smile and closed his eyes again. I turned, and on hands and knees, as being the safest and speediest way, I made my way up to the top and rushed across the path into the concealed door of the lamas. As I entered, I nearly collided with the serving monk who was there. "Quick, quick," I said, "there's a monk injured on the rocks." As I was speaking, my guide came out of his room and looked inquiringly at the commotion. "Master, master," I said, "I have just found, with the aid of Honorable Puss-Puss, an old monk who is injured. He has a head injury, and his leg is unnaturally bent. He needs help urgently." My guide speedily gave instructions to the serving monk, and then turned to me. "Lead on, Lobsang, I will follow." Together we went out of Shakpori and crossed the small path. I led him down the steep path, noting with consternation that his saffron robe was getting soiled. My own was so soiled that a few more marks made no difference. Honorable Puss-Puss was there, dancing about on the path ahead of us, and he really looked relieved to see the Lama Mingyar Dondup with me. Soon we reached the old monk, who still had his eyes shut. My guide knelt down beside him and took various packages from the inner pan of his robe, bandages and some stuff which he held on a piece of cloth and held beneath the old monk's nose. The monk sneezed violently and opened his eyes, eyes which were strained and pain-racked. He looked a very relieved monk indeed when he saw who was attending to him. "It is all right, friend. Help is coming for you," said my guide. With that, the old monk closed his eyes again and sighed with relief. My guide raised the monk's robe, and we saw bits of bone sticking through the skin of the leg just beneath the knee. My guide said, "Hold his hands, Lobsang. Hold him tightly. Rest your weight so that he cannot move. I'm going to pull the leg straight." With that, he caught hold of the monk's ankle, and with a very swift, sudden pull, straightened the limb, and I saw the bones disappear inside the skin. It was so sudden, so carefully done, that the old man did not even have time to groan. Quickly, my guide reached out two branches, which were very convenient, to hang onto a fairly big bush. With a knife, he cut them off, and, padding them with a piece of his own robe, he bound them as a splint on the monk's leg. Then we just sat back to wait. Soon there came shufflings and scufflings as a party of monks, led by a lama, appeared coming down the path. We called to them and directed them to the place where we were. Carefully, they grouped about the old monk. One young monk, not at all carefully, tried to show off and tried to show how sure-footed he was. His foot slipped on the loose stones. His feet slipped out from under him, and he started to slide down the mountainside. A shrub caught the bottom of his robe and pulled it up over his head, and there he was like a peeled banana, swinging naked to the gaze of pilgrims on the ring road below. My guide chuckled and gave orders for two others to rescue him without delay. When he was pulled back, he was looking very shamefaced and very red-faced too. I noticed that he would have to stand for a few days if he wanted to be comfortable, because the place in contact with the floor when sitting was quite badly scratched by the stones. Cautiously, the monks turned to the injured man so that they could slide beneath him a length of strong canvas. Then they turned him back and pulled so that he was upon a convenient stretcher. They tucked the cloth right around him, forming a tube of it, and then they slid a stout pole inside, binding him to the pole by broad lengths of webbing. He was unconscious, fortunately. And then two monks raised the ends of the pole, and with others behind, helping by pushing and steadying their footsteps, they made their way slow, cautiously through the bushes, up the mountain path, and into the safety of Shakpuri. I stood patting Honorable Puspus, telling my guide the Lama Mingyar Dondup how Honorable Puspus had fetched me down to come to the aid of the old man. "The poor old fellow would probably have died if you had not called, Honorable Puspus," said my guide, ruffling the old cat's furs. Then he turned to me, saying, "Good work, Lobsang. You have started well. keep it up. Together we scrambled up the mountain path, both of us envying Honorable Puss-Puss, who danced and gambolled ahead. My guide entered Shakpori, but I stayed, sitting on the boulder at the top, teasing Honorable Puss-Puss with a piece of bark, a nice, flexible piece of bark, which he pretended was some fierce enemy. He leaped and growled and roared and attacked the bark, and together we had the strongest sense of warm friendship. End of chapter 12.